welcome to episode 417 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We are the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous, share news, and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. On Thursday, September 14th at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, I am teaching a free class. It's the class that I teach every Thursday evening for LSAT Demon Live subscribers, and this one is going to be open to everybody. All you need is an LSAT Demon free account. Go to lsat.link/free if you would like to get information and register for that class. Again, it's Thursday, September 14th, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, a free two-hour, all levels, all topics LSAT class. Hope to see you there. News, we've got scores coming out. August 2023 scores are going to come out 2 days after this episode airs. That's coming out on August 30th. Apparently, if you successfully took the retake from the August LSAT, there were a bunch of, there was a big snafu with Prometric on this last test administration, but they have said that if you took the retake successfully, you will get your scores with everybody else on August 30th. So that's good news. Next deadline you need to think about is August 31st is the registration deadline for the October 2023 test. And it's real easy to decide whether you should register. Basically, are you happy with your practice test scores? If this episode's coming out on Monday, August 28th, you really have a good idea whether you are going to be ready to take the October LSAT. Are you happy with your practice test scores? Then register. If you're not happy with your practice test scores, then don't register. If you're within 5 points, then, you know, maybe it's worth registering. But if you're like 15 points away, then just don't waste your money. Don't waste your time. Don't register for a test that you are not ready for. We've got an email here at the top of the agenda from Nafosat. Subject, the October LSAT. I'll let you read it, Ben.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I hope you have been good. I have a question to ask. I don't know if I should register for the October LSAT.
Oh, perfect. We were just talking about that.
Yep. My PTs range from 162 to 171. My average score is 164. I'm aiming at above 170, and I'm not comfortable with this average score to register. I want to use all my 5 attempts if I needed. I can take the test only in October, January, April, June, since I'm outside of the US. The next test I can register would be the 2024 January one if I miss this one, and my fifth would be the January 2025. Frowny face. I need your advice. Best regards. Nafosat.
Yeah, it's a bummer that they only offer these four administrations for international students. I still I'm confused as to why they do it that way. They have always done it that way. They've always had fewer administrations for out of the country applicants.
Mm-hmm.
But now that they administer the test online, I am confused as to why they do that. It does make it harder to take the test and to attend law school in the United States. As Nafosat here is dealing with. I commend her for wanting to use all of her 5 attempts if necessary. I also commend her for not wanting to take the test if she's not ready. She has scored above 170 on an actual practice test.
She's got a couple months. I mean, given the limited number of tests that she can take abroad, I would consider signing up and then withdrawing or...
Yeah.
Well, potentially lose that money, but you also keep that option open.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She's talking about registering for the October test. Oh, wait. Right. Okay. And that is what we're talking about is the October registration deadline. That's the other thing I don't understand is why the registration deadline has to be so damn far in advance of the actual test.
Yeah.
But whatever. I don't make the rules. We're just trying to play the game. There is to be played. Yeah, I think I probably would register if I were her. It's her first attempt. Schools only care about your highest score. She has a 171 on her practice test record. You don't have to be happy with the average of your practice test scores. You have to be happy with the range of your practice test scores. And the only thing that really matters is the upside of the range, right? Because if you're planning to take it multiple times if necessary, and she's going to have tons of time to prep in between, like she's going to continue to prep, right? I think it's pretty clear that she's going to be more ready in January than she is going to be in October. That said, it seems like she's pretty close to being ready to take it now. I mean, there is some chance that she's going to score in the 170s. And even if that's only a 20% chance, let's say, I mean, would you give her a 20% chance of scoring in the 170s? I think I probably would by the time the October test rolls around.
Yeah, her average is 164. So she is scoring more of those, right? Tests have been on the lower end of that range. So her chances are maybe, 15%. I don't know.
Yeah, 10%, 20%, something like that. But that might be worth it for a first attempt. You know, it's not like she's never scored in the 170s. She has scored in the 170s. Like she has scored a number that she's aiming for.
Sure.
And so, yeah, most of the time she doesn't, but some of the time she does. And especially because she only has four cracks at it in the whole year of 2024. Yeah, I think probably go ahead and register.
Yeah. You know, this would be a totally different story if this weren't your first attempt, right? If it were your third attempt or something like that, you got to preserve those remaining attempts much more cautiously.
Right. Yeah. But because it's your first attempt and because it's not like totally fantasy land, right? If she was averaging 154 and the highest she had ever scored was 161 and she was like, well, I'm really shooting for 170. Then I would say absolutely do not register.
Yeah, you're not.
But
there
here,
yet.
She's in that gray area. And given the fact that she's international and has fewer attempts at the test, I think the answer is, yeah, go for it. Enough of that.
Yeah, cool.
Thanks for writing in. I'm not sure how much we have to say about this next one. We have an article here from Reuters about the University of Chicago paying a $13.5 million settlement to resolve claims that it conspired with other elite schools to restrict financial aid. Plaintiffs sued 17 elite U.S. colleges in 2022 in Chicago federal court, alleging that hundreds of thousands of students paid artificially inflated tuition because the schools unlawfully colluded to restrict financial aid offers. The plaintiffs have claimed billions of dollars in damages. University of Chicago paid out a settlement. I don't think this applies to law school specifically. It applies to undergrad.
True. I thought it was interesting to me that Chicago's defense was, hey, we left this cartel. They literally said the word cartel way back in 2004 or 2014 or something like that. So these claims are baseless. It's just funny to me that they admitted in some ways that they were in some sort of cartel with these other schools. But then they said, we look forward, and this I'm quoting them right now, we look forward to putting this matter behind us and continuing to focus our efforts on expanding access to a transformative undergraduate education. I just thought, hey, man, that's their word, right? It's like they all go to school and they learn, okay, this is how you sell education. You call it
transformative. That's the magic word. Yeah. Hey, it worked on me back at UC Hastings back in the day. Other schools accused in the scheme included Brown University, Yale University, Cornell, Johns Hopkins. Yeah. I mean, it's like the most prestigious schools in the United States. And apparently they were in some kind of a cartel to try to charge people more, essentially. So they're being sued for antitrust and price fixing.
Yeah.
I guess just, you know, for our listeners, the warning is, you know, these schools are going to act like they're your best friend. They're going to talk like they're just, oh, we're all about you.
Yeah.
We're here to educate you. We're going to offer you access to transformative education, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But you're a business. You know, whether you're a nonprofit or a for-profit doesn't really matter. You're a business. You generate billions of dollars in revenue as a group. and millions or tens or hundreds of millions of dollars as an individual university. And it's all about money. I mean, they're trying to sell you a wildly expensive product, and you need to realize that they're in it for themselves. They're just not in it for you.
Yep.
And these are the like, this is supposed to be the, you know, the most, you would think that like some shitty, you know, Trump university or whatever would be the ones that were guilty of this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But nah, it's all of them. They're just all, they're all part of this giant money grab. And the solution is just don't pay for law school.
Well, you know, even more so at the elite level, right? Because the mission, well, I don't know if mission is the right word, but one of the key objectives of the school is to be competitive. And so to be competitive, they need to get the best applicants, but they also need to get money to continue to attract the best applicants. So it's this, there's these institutional pressures, right? To maybe, this is just an allegation, but maybe to engage in sort of these behaviors. But when I was looking at universities with my oldest son, we talked to a variety of them. And one of the universities that we talked to, their mission was entirely different. They were just a state-run school. And the, you know, again, this could be salesmanship, but first of all, it was extraordinarily cheap already compared to
that's a good sign. Like, yeah. If it's cheap, okay, then yeah, we can already tell that you maybe have different priorities. Go ahead.
Yes. I mean, $3,000 a semester for tuition is just so astronomically different in terms of compared to other undergrad pricing, right? That you're like, okay, you're already playing a different game. But the advisor we were talking to was explaining how to enroll and save money, and then also suggesting other schools that might help my son achieve his goals.
Wow.
Right. And I just said, I mean, I said in the conversation, I was like, this is an interesting experience, because it doesn't seem like you obviously are excited about what your university has to offer. At the same time, you don't seem to be selling it very hard. And he said, well, you have to understand, our mission is to educate the state. And so it's, you know, we have a different, like, whether you come here or not doesn't affect us that much. We want to educate people. If they're interested, come. If they're not, then they need to go somewhere else. That's fine. That's not what's going on at these elite schools, right? They are trying their hardest to get the best applicants to further their objective of competing.
Yeah.
Money. Not saying that's their only objective, but it's certainly a factor.
Money is just a very corrupting influence, you know? And when they're charging $3,000 a year, they're sort of
3,000 a semester, but 6,000 a year.
Semester, 6,000 a year. Okay. But that's like, that would be a reasonable amount that would actually pay for the services that kid is going to get.
Yeah.
When they're charging $30,000 a semester, like law schools charge.
Yeah.
That's separated from the actual product. Like there's so much profit built into that. And it's, you know, so then it's greed and overpaid administrators, overpaid faculty. And even if it's a nonprofit, somebody's making that money. That money's going somewhere, and it ain't to the services that the kids are going to get. Trust me. You know, I mean, maybe it is in the form of professor making millions of dollars, but that's only nominally a benefit to the students. Like it's the student experience. You're still going to have a, you know, talking head at the top, at the front of the room with 100 something people in the room. And you're not actually getting much out of that celebrity professor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay. This next one is kind of related to this topic of conversation. It's from Anonymous. The subject is, what is a reasonable price to pay for law school?
Hi, Ben and Nathan. Ideally, the price I end up paying for law school is $0. But if it comes down to it, I am willing to pay something for a great law school. I worked a part-time job in college and will graduate with no debt and about $75,000 in investments. Holy shit. Nice work.
Good job.
I have competitive scores, but I recognize that a full ride from a T14 is pretty hard to come by. Do you believe it's reasonable to pay $30,000 to $40,000 a year? Or am I better off going to a school like this must be Wash U for free if given the choice?
Well, we've talked about it so much on the show before. If you're paying $30,000 to $40,000 a year for Harvard, then, you know, Harvard has endowment money. They have super robust loan repayment programs. They have their, you know, there might be reasons. And many of our LSAT demon teachers, you know, who are really smart people, and they believe us, they listen to us, they take our advice. But still, we have, you know, members of our team who leave us to go to those kinds of schools and pay that kind of price.
Yeah.
So if you're actually talking about Harvard, Stanford, Yale, then okay, I can see how it might be worth it to pay $30,000 to $40,000 a year. Maybe. I'm not telling you, yes, that's a good idea. I'm saying I would consider the argument if we are talking about the truly elite of the elite. But it's not as hard as you think to get a full ride to a top 14. There are top 14s that give full rides, including stipends.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, but some of them do. And so I would cross that bridge when we come to it. I think you should apply broadly. I think you should evaluate all of your offers when they come in. And then I think we should be talking about specific offers rather than this like theoretical, is it worth it to pay $30,000 to $40,000 a year? We do say don't pay for law school at the end of every show. But I don't want people to take that so absolutely that they're not willing to pay anything at all. I thought Anonymous was going to say, is it reasonable to pay $5,000 to $10,000 a year?
Yeah.
But $30,000 to $40,000 a year it's clearly separated from the product that you're getting. Like you're just paying for prestige at that point. You're not going to get any better education. You're paying for prestige. You're paying for a name. You're paying for ego inflation. And yeah, I mean, just default presumption is no, it's not fucking worth $30,000 a year. How could it possibly be? It's just not. I don't know. And the way you put yourself in the position to decide that it's not worth it is you go ahead and apply broadly, you know, so that you actually have that Wash U full ride and you actually have that, you know, UCLA generous offer and you actually have that Michigan generous offer and other schools in the top 14. And then you see what the whole, you know, portfolio of offers looks like. And then you take the one that's the best value for you.
Yeah. I mean, this illustrates the power of anchoring, right? Schools have done an excellent job of anchoring people at a very high price so that 30 to 40 sounds reasonable, but it's not.
Yeah, well, it's like what Princeton Review does with their LSAT class, right? It's like, well, our class costs $2,200, but we'll give your pre-law society an $800 discount.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then the price comes out to be $1,400 and you now think it's reasonable because you got anchored on that $2,200 and now $1,400 looks like a deal, but it's just not a deal. And $30,000, $40,000 a year is not a deal. That is wildly overinflated, you know, maybe not by a full order of magnitude, but pretty damn close. When you see what you're actually getting, you know, it's like you don't get rent. You don't get food. You don't get a car.
Yeah.
What do you get? You get the privilege to sit in a lecture hall. You get the privilege to go to the bookstore and buy $2,000 worth of books per semester. You know, what is that $30,000 to $40,000? It's the name on a transcript. It's the name on the resume.
Well, this is another thing that law schools have done successfully. Maybe all grad schools have done this as well. But in undergrad, you constantly talk about the cost of education. So you talk about tuition plus everything else, room and board, food, all that shit, right?
Yeah.
But when we talk about law school, all we ever talk about is tuition. We do it too. You don't talk about, okay, well, you're also going to have to live. You're going to have to pay for food. So the cost isn't 30 to 40 a year. There's another 20 on top of that, right?
Oh, yeah. At least. We're not even talking about fees either, right? Because, like, there's some schools that are like, oh, no, no, that's a, oh, what? That $875 per semester fee. Yeah, that's for the student rec center.
Yeah, yeah. Or student success fee. That's one student success fee. That I just saw on our tuition bill.
The extra profit for us fee. Jesus. All right. Next email is from Perrin. Subject is scholarship bargaining. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I have a couple broad questions regarding a phrase I've heard on this podcast before, and that is scholarship bargaining. What does this look like? How do you initiate that process? Can you use higher LSAT scores you got after submitting your application to bargain? I think the word we always use is negotiate.
Yeah. yeah.
Thanks for your advice, Perrin. We have a link here, and we'll mention it out loud, too, on LSAT Demon Daily, episode 163. It was called How to Negotiate Law School Scholarships, and it had Matt and Becca, who both ended up on very generous scholarships from University of Maryland Law. So you can hear a whole episode about how to negotiate your scholarships. I think, you know, if we can just take 30 seconds to give the bullet points. Apply broadly. If you apply everywhere, you're already putting yourself in a good negotiating position because you have alternatives. If you only apply to one school, then you kind of have to take what they're going to give you. If you apply broadly, then you're like, well, wait a second. Why would I take your shitty offer when I have this great offer over here? Two, ask for more money.
Sorry, before we go, I just want to analogize here. This is maybe, imagine you're dating someone, right? And you have like 10 other people who really want to start a relationship with you, right? Yeah. If things aren't going well, then you're just like, okay, see you later. I'll talk to somebody else. But if you don't feel like there's anyone out there, then you're going to feel constrained or whatever, right? I mean, yeah. I'm not suggesting anyone does this, but I want people to like feel what it's like to free yourself up by having options.
Yeah. Taking the first offer is like, you know, marrying your junior high sweetheart. That's just probably not going to work out. You probably need to, you know, see what's out there first and then make a decision about what's the best fit for you. If you apply to just one school or if you apply to just a couple schools, you're just limiting your options for, you know, the negotiation isn't always just talking to the school and asking them for more money.
Yeah.
It's putting yourself in the position so that you know your worth in the marketplace. And if you don't apply, you know, that's why we always say apply early, apply broadly, apply with the best LSAT you can get. Because if you don't do that, then you're just putting yourself in this position where you don't know what you're actually worth. And that's going to be bad times. Once you do have a school that you think that you like, you should ask them for a better offer. Ask them for more money. And I don't care how you do it. You can do it on the phone. You can do it on an email. You can do it in person. But however you've been communicating with these schools, you just say, hey, and you know, maybe you mention another competitive offer that you have.
Yeah.
Or maybe you just say something like, you know, I am very concerned about this cost. My parents aren't paying for this. You could say I have a child. You could say I have to leave this very lucrative career. There's a thousand things you could say. You know, you could say I'm a teacher. You could say I've been working in nonprofit. I don't know. There's so many things you could say to just give reasons for why you're asking. But then you essentially what you do is you just say, is there anything you can do to reevaluate my scholarship offer?
Yeah.
And you ask. And if they say we don't renegotiate scholarship offers, you say, OK, yeah, but can I come talk to you and share my concerns with you?
Yeah.
You know, you got to be like a lawyer. Lawyers are pesky, right? Lawyers are going to keep asking for what they want. And the people who ask get more money. To the tune of tens of thousands of dollars more money.
Yep.
And, you know, their first no might actually be real. They might end up saying no and no and no, and you might give up.
Yep.
But if you don't ask, then you're just taking a no, your self-imposed no.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to give you more money than they think they have to give you in order to attract you to their school. So just ask.
Yeah.
Okay. Next one came in via LSAT Demon support.
Okay. I've heard from a few other Demon subscribers that the general idea is to, quote, save the newer, most recent PTs for closer to when you're going to take your test. However, I've had yet to hear a single LSAT Demon teacher mention this thought process. To confirm, is there any merit to this thought process?
No. No, we don't. We don't fetishize the most recent PTs. We don't save them. They're nothing different. They're nothing special. You do not need to be saving practice tests.
Okay.
Full stop.
Pearls versus turds.
Okay. This is where we take some received potential wisdom from the internet and we tell you whether it is a pearl of wisdom or whether it's a turd. This is coming from LSAT Demon team member Elizabeth. It says, when I taught wrong answer wreckers, which was a class at LSAT Demon, I had a trick I used for main point questions on reading comp. You know, when you're at a bar and your friend is telling you a crazy story and then you hear the actual story from another friend and it's nothing like your friend described? That's 4 out of 5 answers on a reading comp main point question. Reverse engineer an answer choice by picturing what a passage that is based on that answer choice would look like. Then think about what the passage actually was about. It's a horrible match 4 out of 5 times. I kind of like this idea. What do you think?
Hard to say until I try it. I just don't want to spend too much time on an answer, but maybe I'm actually doing some form of this. So maybe this, I'm just making this suggestion bigger than it is. I do like to focus in on the verb of the sentence. So what is that sentence actually saying in that answer choice? And a lot of times when I do that, I'm like, no, that was not the thrust of the passage. So
No, I think there's something here enough that I'm tentatively leaning toward Pearl. And I agree with you, Ben, that there is a hazard here for students to think that they have to like spend forever explaining why wrong answers are wrong. Mm-hmm. But I do frequently, and I do this on LR as well, on reasoning questions or on flaw questions or even on must be true questions, I guess, now that I think about it. I frequently do a thing like, well, no, because in order for that to be correct, the passage would have to have said XYZ, you know, or wait, on a flaw question, for example, nah, in order for that to be the answer, they would have to have done this. And I know they didn't do that. So it's wrong.
Yeah.
So I like this tip. I can see how I love the idea of, when you're at a bar and your friend is telling you a crazy story and then you hear the actual story and there's just like no connection between the two, that is a nice way of thinking about the wrong answers on main point questions or just on all the answer choices reading comp generally. You know, must be true generally, which reading comp is just a whole bunch of must be true questions. And there are a lot of must be true and supported and, you know, must be true-ish questions on logical reasoning as well. Those wrong answers are like, wait a sec, nah, that's not what happened. That ain't it. That's not what they did. So I think in that spirit, I'm willing to give this tip a pearl.
Okay. If you got a pearl versus turd candidate, let us know at thinkinglsat.com or find us on social at thinkinglsat. If you reach out there, you'll get in contact with Ashley and then she'll connect with us. So.
Next one is coming from Anonymous. Subject is, I'm boring.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. First, I love the demon! Exclamation point. I cringe when I get a flashback of me trying to use prep books. Second, I'm boring. I'm at the point of my LSAT journey where I'm writing my personal statement. I have nothing to talk about. I know it's not advised to talk about what's on your resume or something that has happened in the past.
Huh?
Wait. What else are you going to talk about? That's what you're going to talk about.
Your personal statement is where your resume comes to life. Your personal statement is absolutely supposed to be about something that happened in the past. Your personal statement should be, for me, the most compelling personal statements are ones where you tell me about something that you kicked ass at work. Like, don't rehash your whole resume.
No, that's too broad. It's too high level.
But tell me what that means. Tell me what that top item on your resume means.
Yeah, I always think of it as taking one bullet point and either telling us a story about that bullet point, or even taking that bullet point and just telling us even a smaller portion of it. It's like you're zooming in on one part of your life.
You're explaining it. You're giving me a vignette.
Mm-hmm.
Continue reading.
I work full time Monday through Friday in billing and do school online. Online schooling had made it possible for me to work and get my degree. I work and go to school. Boring. I'm 21 and think my work experience might want to be highlighted, but I'm not sure. Do you have any advice? Thanks.
Yeah, you've got to tell me what billing means. I don't know what that means. I've never worked in billing.
Yeah.
But you know what? Billing is important for businesses. And I want to know what you do in billing. Explain to me what your job is. Explain to me what types of problems you solve. Explain to me how you are valuable to the company you work for. The fact that you work and go to school at the same time, that's not boring. You're a killer. You're a worker.
Yeah. A lot of kids don't do that. They just go to school and then party.
Yeah. And lawyering, it's like, they want worker bees. They want people who know how to work their ass off. You know how to work your ass off. So let that come to life by showing me what it looks like to kick ass at your job and kick ass at school at the same time. This is not boring at all. At least not. I think, you know, people don't understand how boring law is. People don't understand how boring lawyers are.
Yeah.
Lawyers work their ass off all the time on things that are at least as dry as billing. And, you know, serious people like serious lawyers and serious, you know, business owners, employers, they're going to be interested in your experiences working in billing.
Yep.
I get it that on the surface as a resume point, it sounds boring. But when you get in there and solve problems and do a great job at your job, then that's not boring at all. That's exactly what type of shit makes, you know, good future law firm associates.
Yeah.
All right. Next one is from Mason. It's about logical reasoning. It says, hey, Ben and Nathan, I hope you guys are doing well. After drilling every day and seemingly getting most questions that I attempt correct. There's a couple things you could attack there. Well, and most. Like most means more than half, which is not good. I mean, it's better than less than half, but more than half is there's a wide range there. And you should be getting all of the questions that you attempt correct when you're drilling, right? You have unlimited time. You're going slowly, carefully. The idea is that you're just not going to miss any. And when you do miss one, you need to get pissed off about it. Not just, oh, well, I'm getting most of them right, so I'll just move on.
Yeah,
it needs to be, what the hell? I did not. What? That's not the answer. Huh? And then you need to dig in and spend however long you need to spend there to make sure that you understand exactly why the wrong answer is wrong, exactly why the right answer is right. Not just, oh, well, you know, I got the previous one right and then I missed this one, but I get most of them right. Like, let's move on. That's not doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, after seemingly getting most questions that I attempt correct, I'm still hitting minus 10 on LR timed sections. I feel as if I'm understanding what I'm reading, too. Am I missing something? Yeah, you're missing questions. I mean, you're not understanding what you're reading. If you miss a question, it means you misunderstood the argument, or you misunderstood the question, or you misunderstood the answer that was correct that you didn't pick, or you misunderstood the answer that you did pick that is incorrect. But that's like the only way you miss questions on the LSAT is you didn't understand what you read, because the questions make perfect sense on their face. That's how this test is designed. If you read it carefully, you can figure it out. You can get it right. And you're not. You're getting it wrong. So you need to read it more carefully. You need to slow down and you need to take your time with every question, and you need to get them right.
Yeah. One thing that might help with that, Mason, is you're focusing on how many are getting wrong in the time sections, minus 10. Don't focus on that number. Focus on the number you're getting correct of the ones you attempt and try to get close to 100% correct of the ones you do. Yeah. You're focusing on the wrong metric. Yeah.
Yep, totally. And when you do timed sections, it's okay that there's going to be a bunch at the end of the section that you're not going to get to. And yeah, you're going to miss 4 out of 5 of those. You're going to randomly guess on those questions and you'll get 1 out of 5 of them right for free.
Yeah.
But the 4 out of 5 that you miss, I don't really care about those ones. I care about the ones that you attempted in the timed section and still missed anyway. Those are the one, that's your problem. That's your real problem, because that's where it's a complete waste of time. The time you did spend on it was a complete waste because you didn't get it correct. So you didn't read it correctly. You just, you know, I know you feel as if you're understanding it, but if you picked a wrong answer, then you did not understand it.
Yep.
Pretty simple. All right. Last one here is from R about extenuating circumstances.
Hey, Demon Team. I requested an exemption from the test taking limit. Okay. I'm assuming that's the 5 test limit. They denied my request, citing that my situation did not meet the threshold for a significant and extenuating circumstance to warrant an exception. Does someone need to die or be in extreme harm as a result of my inability to retake the test in order for my request to be granted? I cited my last 5 practice test scores. 165, 167, 174, 164, 166, in my request to indicate that my 162 was underperformance and that I could do better.
Oh, but they don't give a shit about that. That's not a good... You made a bad case for yourself, R. I'm sorry, but like that's not what they mean. That's not what they care about. They don't give a shit I could do better. So that's why I want to take it again. Of course, that's why you want to take it again, because you think you could do better. Mm-hmm. You citing practice test scores is not going to be compelling for them.
R continues, the 162 is also my highest score on record. I also sent them a letter of reconsideration, which they denied as well.
Ouch.
I am re-eligible for the remaining 2 attempts after July 2025. Any advice on what would constitute an extenuating circumstance? Best regards, R. Yeah, you need to talk about why you should have those 2 attempts earlier.
Yeah. Let's imagine. We have a link here to the limits on repeating the test.
Mm-hmm.
There are exceptions to the policy. So if any of the tests that you took were part of the LSAT flex that they did in like an emergency response to COVID, that was already 3 years ago now. Wow. May, June, July, and August of 2020, LSAT flex tests do not count toward these limits. So if any of those were part of that, then I think you might have gotten it automatically. Tests taken prior to September 19 don't count. There is an appeals process, but it does not give any examples of extenuating circumstances. What types of things do you think they actually might be compelled by?
Well, the reason I'm saying focus on those 2 tests, first of all, is that to me, it's an argument that's less about getting more. It's just about getting it earlier. So they're not giving you more than what you can already get. So it seems like less of an ask, right? Hey, I want those 2 tests. I just want them like a year early. And then I would probably focus on, boy, what are some reasons why you would need to go to law school now? We're so bad at that. We're always telling people to delay, but.
Well, yeah. I mean, the truth is, you probably don't need to go to law school right now. You probably can just wait another couple of years, work, get some better work experience, continue to prep for the LSAT. You know, by the time July 2025 rolls around, you should be solidly in the 170s based on your practice test. Your current practice test record is good. But like, why are you in such a hurry to put a 166 on your record? You know, like that's not that great. It's better than your 162, but I guess don't fall into the same trap that you've already been falling into, which is like you've already been taking the test clearly too often.
Prematurely. Yeah.
You're, you know, if it's great that your practice test scores are up there where they are. I mean, above your 162. And yeah, you're a good bet to score higher than your 162 on record. But why are you trying to squeak out a few more points when there's still like 15 more points available to you?
Mm-hmm.
I would maybe reconsider this idea of whether you want to try to appeal. I think the ship has already sailed for you, though, R. I mean, you applied. They denied it. You then appealed. They denied that, too. At this point, you know, when you re-appeal, I don't know. I'm not optimistic.
I'm not optimistic either, but I do think if you shift you totally shift your messaging, you could recover. You could say, hey, look, I'm sorry. I don't even know how you say this, but you could try again. You can try again and focus on something different. But
I think
the real question is whether you want
circumstances.
To. Yeah. If, like your job, right? You're like, hey, look, my job is set to end in 6 months. It's going to be very difficult for me to get another job that's equally as well paying for a limited time to then continue my law school education. They're going to be sympathetic to that kind of shit because they want people to go to law school. That doesn't mean they're going to be sympathetic to you in particular, but it's the kind of argument that people in that industry buy into.
Extenuating is defined as serving to lessen the seriousness of an offense. Library staff will waive fines where there are genuine extenuating circumstances. But then, like, here's another example of its use. Hunger and poverty are not treated by the courts as extenuating circumstances.
Ouch.
Yeah. It's a relative term. It's, you know, it's going to be in the, you have to like pull on the heartstrings of whoever is reading this appeal.
Yep, exactly. That's where the job thing may help, or, you know, something like, hey, it's going to be tough for me.
I would actually think about illness, poverty, hunger, job requirements, taking care of a ailing grandparent. You're going to get deported if you don't go to law school this cycle. But it has to be something that seems to be out of your control.
Yeah.
And you made a real bad case for yourself on that first that first letter telling them your practice test record there. I think like you showed them your cards, you know.
Yeah.
Your cards are, I think I can do better. And that's exactly what they don't want to hear. I mean, you told them the exact wrong thing in your first attempt.
Yeah.
So I think you just might be fucked. But if I was going to write an appeal, it would be something like, it doesn't necessarily need to be somebody's going to die. But I think it needs to be like, hey, listen, there's really nothing I can do here. I have to do this early because of some reason. There has to be something out of your control.
But again, why, right? Get your score up. Get your score up to that 174. You have it on record in your practice tests. Get more of those.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you got a pretty wide range there on your practice test scores, which that's fairly normal that people have a, you know, potentially 10-point swing between their best and their worst in their last five practice tests. But your upside is there. Like you've got a lot of upside and you're not really showing it on all of your tests. So, it could be in your favor actually, R, if you just wait, keep prepping and take those two more attempts when they let you take those two more attempts. Time flies, man. The older you get, the more you're going to realize that like 2 years will be here. Nothing. And it's just really not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry, we don't have better news for you, R. You can be LSAT famous. Please ask us questions or share news with us at LSAT, thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about LSAT Demon, you can email the world's best help team at help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 417 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.